Mr. Shapiro, are you with us?
In a manner of speaking, yes.
Do you mind, would you, he is a great ex-president, isn't he, old Jimmy?
Oh, well, there's no doubt that Jimmy Carter he's probably the greatest ex-president. There is no one else who has so consistently used his status to intervene in a meaningful way on behalf of peace and democracy, and it should be said, mental health as well. All three of them are the kind of linchpins of the Carter Center, and you see his footprint in eradication of diseases. You see his footprint in monitoring of elections. You see his footprint in peace negotiations all over the world. It's a remarkable post-presidential life that seems to just go on and on.
Of course, when he was the 39th president, he got a few runs on the board before things got unstuck. He was very progressive on race issues for a Georgian.
Well, he came into the presidency as a champion of civil rights and an ally of the civil rights movement in an era as a kind of new Southern politician. He'd been the governor of Georgia, had been an ally of civil rights protesters like John Lewis and Jesse Jackson. He made notable appointments of African Americans to the federal bench and to Andrew Young, one of Martin Luther King's associates, as UN ambassador. This was a person who did understand the enormous epical change that had swept the American South.
And then, Bruce, it all comes unstuck with the hostage crisis, and this is its 40th birthday. Remind the listener what the crisis actually was.
Well, the backdrop is that for all of the good Jimmy Carter wanted to do in human rights and other areas, he was heir to the Cold War, and one of the key American allies in the Cold War was the tyrannical and brutal Shah of Iran. In 1979, the Shah was overthrown by the revolution, Islamic Republic, led by Ayatollah Khomeini. The Shah fled, but he had cancer. And the United States, under President Carter, admitted Shah Reza Pahlavi to the U.S. for his treatment. Iran wanted him back. Iran wanted to put the Shah on trial for the crimes of his notorious secret police, the SAVAK, and for other abuses in his power. On November 4th, November 4th, 1979, a group of student protesters invaded the American embassy in Tehran and took a whole group of the diplomatic staff hostage. And it went on, this crisis went on for 444 days. Was a subject of nightly news updates, repeated negotiations, ultimately a failed rescue attempt toward the end of the Carter presidency, and really along with the energy crisis, which was unfolding and also involved the Mideast, of course, really turned popular tide against the new president.
He was swept from office, wasn't he? It was a catastrophe.
Well, one of the first of many outcomes for the hostage crisis was the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, 1 year after, almost to the day. A year almost to the day after the crisis had begun, after the hostages were taken. One of the real immediate consequences of the hostage situation was an upsurge in American nationalism that had taken a lot of hits during the Vietnam War over the preceding decade. Suddenly, you began hearing those chants of USA, USA, which now are kind of familiar, but they come out of that surge of nationalism in the Iran hostage period. So one of the first, but by no means the only consequence, was the election of Ronald Reagan and everything, the turn of American politics toward a conservative direction instead of the progressive post-civil rights direction that Jimmy Carter, the human rights direction that Jimmy Carter hoped to lead the American nation.
And there were quite a lot of dominoes falling as a consequence in the region.
Well, sure. First of all, you had changes in other regimes. You had in the Reagan presidency, the Iran-Contra affair, in which Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North thought he could secretly trade arms with the Iranians, who were had sanctions against them, in return for money that would fund the Contras in Latin America, the anti-Sandinista rebels. So, in a sense, the Iran hostage crisis also gave us the kind of secret use of the executive branch to pursue private agendas in international affairs that we're now seeing play out again in a different way in what we're learning about Ukraine. That's also a legacy. It certainly strengthened as well the hand of the Ayatollah within Iran and set up the dynamic in much more enduring way. It froze the dynamic of relations between the U.S. and Iran right where they were at the moment that the Shah was overthrown for now an entire generation.
We could stay on the story and talk about the way it also energized Saddam Hussein and the conflicts between Iraq and Iran, but we have other topics we must discuss. So let's get on to the impeachment hearings. An update, please, Shapiro.
Well, you know, I kind of keep saying every week, well, we're at a crucial week. It's a slow drip drip, but we actually are at a pivotal moment right now, I think in two ways. First of all, the Democrats in the House did formally vote last week to formalize the impeachment inquiry. That doesn't mean impeachment is guaranteed, but it is now on the record answering one of the main complaints of the White House and its allies. And in addition, the Democrats in the House have switched to the public phase of this inquiry. We've seen transcripts now of the previously secret hearings released, which everyone is still digesting, but show a lot of incoherence among the Republican questioners and which kind of clarify what some of the witnesses have been saying. And we're going to begin getting public hearings, actual public testimony, next week. That's one very important change. And at the same time, the White House has now decided to, in the face of this public inquiry, which is what it said it wanted, is now going for broke on executive privilege, refusing to let numerous key officials, including the deputy head of the National Security Council, others who had knowledge of the Ukrainian deal of Giuliani's back-channel negotiations, refusing to let any of those people testify. So we've got a sweeping claim of executive privilege that seems to have very little grounding in law, which is likely to become itself an article of impeachment, obstructing a congressional inquiry. And then, as if that weren't enough, last night came the remarkable news that Lev Parnas, one of those two Ukrainian fixers of Rudolph Giuliani, who were arrested a couple weeks ago, Lev Parnas now says he is willing to testify at Congress. Evidently, he has been angry by President Trump at President Trump's repeated denial of any association with him. He says he has spent a lot of time with the president, and he's changed lawyers from the White House lawyer John O'Dowd to an independent attorney of his own choosing, and the guy plans to testify. So I think we're entering a period where things are going to get a little bit wild and woolly.
Giuliani must be feeling chilly.
Well, he certainly is in the hot seat on this one. He is in the person.
I have him chilly. You have him in the hot seat. But that's not our. Let's leave the temperatures to the discussion of the Paris Accord.
Indeed. So, well, the Paris and the
no, 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 the not Paris. Yet, not yet. So Parnas is sort of going to be helpful in the impeachment process.
Well, you know, one of my most vivid memories of the Watergate crisis is the testimony of a guy named Anthony Yelasowicz, who was a former New York City police officer, who was the committee to reelect the president's bag man. He testified, that is to say, he actually carried cash from illegal cash from donors to Washington, laundered it in Mexico, did all this stuff. And it was one of the more entertaining moments of the gripping Watergate hearings. There's some possibility that Lev Parnas is going to turn into the Anthony Yelasowicz of the Ukraine matter. He is the person who was literally in the middle of this. He knew what Giuliani wanted in Ukraine. He also was a colleague of Dmitry Firtash, the Russian oligarch who was also engaged with Giuliani and who seems to have been very involved in Paul Manafort and seems to be the first person who pushed the narrative that Ukraine was somehow responsible for the DNC server leak. I mean, there's all kinds of strange conspiracy theories that emerged from the relationship between Parnas, Giuliani, Dmitry Firtash, and some of the other figures in this.
We won't have Paris to remember, but you can go back to bed. I'm sorry to shake you up so early for the program, but them's the breaks. Thanks for coming on.